Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
And hello, everybody. This is Rick, and I apologize for being just a minute late here. We've had the AC go out, which is not good if you live here in Austin, Texas. It is the 14th of June, one day before taxes are due on the 15th of June for those who are in business. So we just came off an EMS, and for anybody that might be on this call today from that EMS, what fun. I suspect there might be one person, but there may not be. Who knows? Let's see. First question here for today is, when does one become recovery-oriented? Like, when does doing the right thing rather than what's best for me become the first thought? When does empathy for others have value like money in the bank? When does being a sex addict become an asset rather than a liability? And when does taking a vacation from recovery sound like a bad idea? You know, to me, and maybe recovery is not a good word. Let me start with that last thing. I don't know that I would ever take a vacation from recovery. I don't know what I know that recovery or program are kind of how I live. I mean, I know that I always want to be in a situation where I always say, you know, if you'll never know that God is all you need until God is all you've got, right? And so you need to always be putting yourself in situations where if, you know, the Lord isn't helping you, you're in trouble. So at one level, I want to be living in a way where I'm continually reminded to walk the right way, and I think which answers the first question. When does doing the right thing rather than what's best for me become the first thought? To me, that is such an issue of kind of a recalibrating, what I call that recalibrating of heart and mind on a daily basis, and that occurs by everyday I think putting my hand over my heart and saying, you know, Lord, I'm not that important. I don't have anything anybody needs. Just help me to be have a heart of love. And so it's like a shift of focus, and my focus becomes to be loving and to be caring of others and not to be self-centered. I mean, but that has to become a huge piece of my life if I'm actually going to begin to do that. And when I begin to make that my focus, and maybe in recovery, you know, in Al-Anon, you know, if you go from AA to Al-Anon, you know, you quit focusing on the alcohol and maybe you begin to focus on codependency, or you focus on, I guess, maybe trying to control others, whatever. At times, I think you need to begin to say, okay, what's the bigger issue right now and what do I need to be focused on? And so you make that the focus, and then you start working your program to make sure that's what it's about. And you look at those resentments, and you work the 12 steps about your self-centeredness and about your pride. I mean, obviously, we do that at one level. Any time we go in recovery, we try to get it to where it's not about us. So how long does it take someone to recover from alcoholism might be the question I would ask, and where does it become natural? I think typically in my experience, 12 to 18 months is huge. It's not easy in the first 90 days, and it's not easy in the first 6 months, and I don't think it's really easy for the first 12 months, even though it may begin to feel more natural at 12. And by 18 months, if you're continuing to do it and living and focusing on something different, then it actually becomes more natural according to research. So hopefully that helps. Now, in terms of when does empathy for others have value like money in the bank, I don't know that empathy for others would be the goal. I think having a heart, just a curiosity and a desire, creating almost like the desire to be able to feel and to be a concern for others. I remember once in graduate school, there was this lady, and we were at a meeting, and what was impressive, I remember her in the meeting just being genuinely concerned for the people at this table. It was a business, and we were doing a report on public relations. But her concern was for the people, and I thought it was so juxtaposed against kind of how I felt and what I did. And it just kind of struck me between the eyes that I just wasn't naturally concerned about other people. And I think as I began to grow older, you know, that actually began to carry importance and value to me. And so the goal was just to be concerned for people and to allow myself to feel. And once that becomes the goal, I think it becomes a part of that recovery process. You know, when does being a sex addict become an asset rather than a liability? And you know what? I think it's an asset now if you just see it. Because if it's just getting you to begin to look at life differently and to see your own narcissism and to see your own inability to love, you know what? That's a huge asset. And you know, I always teach that, you know, the thing that ultimately, if we can learn to love people instead of use people, that's going to be huge. And just the fact that maybe I recognize what I've been doing, and it was big. And I think it'll give us a new way of looking at life. So I think we just look at it like that. Question two. How is a hurt spouse to deal with a betrayer's decision to repress their sexual feelings? I know at EMS, we were told that as true intimacy builds, those feelings and desires return. My husband says he feels closer to me than ever and loves, but we've had sex 3 times in 5 months. He's realized that he just can't have sex, and he doesn't know how to like good sex, and he just won't have sex. I don't like this and feel cheated. What can I do? You know, actually, he has got to get some help. So that's not going to change. Usually when I have somebody in this situation, I recommend that they A, see a sex therapist, B, there's some exercises that he needs to do. I have not written that course. I don't know who has on an online basis, but there's some books that you could go through that would probably be useful. A lot of times I have people do Restoring the Pleasure by Pinner and Pinner. When I use Pinner and Pinner's book, of course, I'm a professional taking them through it, but it is something that can be done by a couple. I think other readings, The Gift of Sex, Sheet Music by Lehman, anything like that to begin to look at sex differently. And what you do is you actually read those books out loud to one another so that it can become something you can talk about. But probably if someone doesn't kind of have the tool set to do good sex and all they know is this other, and so all they know to do is become sexually anorexic and constrict, then I suspect there's going to need to be a professional come in or somebody to help him develop a program to work through that, because that's not uncommon. I see it with men, and I see it with women. And certainly the fact that he loves you and cares for you, enjoys the connection with you, but he may not have a clue how to really relate in a way that's safe and loving and caring, and he has to be able to get a vision. And unless someone's giving him that and teaching him how to do that, then I suspect he'll have trouble, so get help. This is from the forum. I know about the 40 calls for my unfaithful husband to do. Do any of you have any other helpful exercises that I could do with my husband as we work moving through our marriage and trying to make it better? Sometimes those of you we've gone through this are better sources for these things than our therapist that we just get to see an hour a week. Thank you for your assistance. Or any good books you have that have really helped your marriage. The 40 cost is a really good exercise. Week 5 in the 911 course, that's actually another empathy development exercise that we do. And in that particular exercise, you know, they're having to write reminders. It's a kind of an understanding of what the emotional battle is like for a couple as they go through this process. And so the reminders become a big deal. And that's a good one. Week 6, when they have to write the letter, is a huge exercise that I think is very good at empathy development. Frequently, I'll have couples do an intimacy exercise where they have to share a feeling each night that they had during the day, and I give them a feeling sheet. And then after they share that feeling, they have to share another time in their life that they had the same feeling. And then they have to tell their mate something they appreciate about them. That feeling exercise is an excellent exercise where you share a feeling. It's an ongoing daily ritual that you begin to set up. But for people who have never really spoken in terms of emotions, and feelings, doing that exercise of trying to identify a feeling or two feelings every day and then sharing another time in life. I usually try to get them prior to marriage at first, just so they get used to begin talking about their feelings, even in the past, and trying to reconnect the past with the future and what those feelings were, and just making them kind of analyze the whole process. So that's another really good exercise. Doug Weiss has a book on... I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the book, but if you go to Doug's website, then he's got a book on just like 100 exercises. And I think some of, I won't say 100, but it's a bunch of exercises. And I think he's got some other suggestions. Another good book would be Hold Me Tight by Sue Johnson, which is on emotionally focused therapy, and it gives some very specific exercises. And if a couple were to read that, I think it would give you some good ideas of things to do. Some of the Married for Life stuff actually would be useful in the sense of we actually do some of the EFT. It talks some about emotions, but it's just going to be a process, and maybe those are some resources that could be helpful. Is it important to identify your own grooming pattern so that you know when you start to relapse? And I would say absolutely. I think it's really scary if people are not attuned to the things they do that set them up. So, you know, I would say in grooming behaviors, if those of you who don't know that, it's the way that we as individuals, in order to kind of fulfill our own need for validation and affirmation, will actually use other, we behave in such a way as to draw people to us. And both, you know, all sexes, male and female, have almost a dance of courtship, a dance of flirting, a dance of engaging that we came into the marriage with. I mean, it's how we got married to begin with. And hopefully we learn as we get older to set boundaries and not to do that stuff anymore. But sometimes we continue those grooming behaviors that would ultimately draw people to us. And just kind of beginning to be aware of that, one of the terms I use is pimping tenderness. I mean, I've got some guys that I've worked with in the past that have been darn good at pimping tenderness. And so they need to be very careful about doing that. And so if you can identify those things, it's going to really help. Why is surrender so difficult for us even when we know it's what works? Well, you know, to me, back to Keating, you know, every man's got to go through a very necessary series of humiliations before they're finally going to be transformed. You know, there's just a part of us in our pride that keeps thinking that we can do it. And so surrender ultimately means that we have to kind of come to a place of acceptance that we can't do it. And giving up and accepting ourselves as imperfect and broken is really difficult. We may be able to give it verbal assent and say, well, yeah, of course I know that I can't really do it. On the other hand, our actions, though, indicate that we still believe that somehow we should be able to do it, or the shame that we feel as a result of not doing it still reveals the fact that, you know, we can say that we know we need to surrender, but it really indicates that we haven't. Performance anxiety, feeling like I'm not doing it good enough is another indication that really I haven't come to acceptance, that I can't do it. And until you get to the acceptance piece, you can't ever really get, you're not going to be willing to surrender and give it up. It's almost like, why would you surrender if you feel like you can still win the battle? And so to me, it always comes down to when people don't surrender, they haven't accepted what they can't do yet. They still believe at one level they should be able to do it, and they should be able to do it, and other people ought to be able to do it. And there's something wrong with them if they don't. Getting it. Let's see. You say it's important for the unfaithful spouse to get it, but how much will they actually ever get? How much is enough for the hurt spouse? You know, I remember one of our mentor couples saying once at EMS, and I really appreciated his, I think his wisdom. He said, you know, bottom line, I finally had to come to the point of acceptance of, you know, my mate was really trying to understand, but she was never going to be able, as a guy, fully understand what it was like from my perspective. It means not that she wasn't trying, it wasn't that she didn't care, but the bottom line is, it just wasn't ever going to happen. And I think there's a lot of maybe just a reality that they can, with empathy, we can do our best, but nobody can ever fully or truly understand. But at least you can see someone's heart's attitude in their attempt to understand. Some people may do better than other people at being able to do that, and they have more ability. What's difficult about getting it is just the other person's willingness to kind of put themselves out there to make it happen. This weekend at EMS, there was an amazing letter that one of the women wrote to her husband to help communicate that she really got it. And it was interesting the way she got her mind to the place of that. And at first, because she still had resentment and hurt about some things he had done, and because of that, when we first started talking about writing the letter to herself, she just, you know, she couldn't get there. And then Katie, one of our interns, said to her, well, you know, what if you wrote it from the perspective, his perspective, when things were really good, as if the negative things had never happened, but at the beginning when you were truly in love. And then she took it one step farther and kind of the whole golden rule thing and said, and really, what is it that you would need to hear yourself, you know? And she said, once she began to think about what she would have wanted to hear, and especially remembering back, again, kind of from the heights from which they had fallen, just because remembered the when he was everything to her and got into that space, once the letter just absolutely flowed. And what she did was she basically remembered that attachment, the good part, and the good man that she had fallen in love with. And what would he say to her? I mean, how devastated would he be as a result? And so we've almost got to be able to somehow clear the lens, I think those of us trying to get it sometimes, and see the person as they, maybe if they really are or not, as we've kind of experienced them over the past few years. And then it's much easier to get into the getting it assignment. But regardless, for the hurt spouse, they're just going to have to accept at some point that, you know, they've made a good faith effort, and it may be years. I mean, I think my process of getting what Stephanie has done has been a long-term process. It has happened over years. It's not something that happens just this week. You know, it's just, it goes, each year I think I understand better. It's kind of sad I understand better and she doesn't hurt anymore, but just that willingness to continue to pursue, to understand, and to even check things out with her, I think really help her know that I care. So, looks like that's all the stuff for today. It is hot in my office, so I'm going to go to the air conditioning and get out of here. You guys, I hope you have a great week. And again, thank you for being on the call here. And we will talk to you next Monday. Bye-bye.